is CBS Eye on the World. Here's John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. It is the spring of 1885. The 22nd president of the United States, Grover Cleveland, former governor of New York, former mayor of Buffalo, former district attorney of Erie County, enters the White House, enters the chief executive's office with a vision of how he will conduct himself. That is the beginning of the policy disputes that will reign over his first term, and then, with the in-between period, his second term. This is the only man to hold the office twice, so effectively he is the 22nd and 24th president. I learned this from a wonderful new book, rich with irony, A Man of Iron, The Turbulent Life and the Improbable Presidency of Grover Cleveland. Troy Seneca is the author. I welcome Troy, I congratulate him, and I begin with the policies of spring of 1885. Troy, the president is faced with stories of silver and gold, stories of tariff reform, stories of civil service reform. It's all quite overwhelming for us now to imagine how Congress is going to deal with these. But the chief executive had a style that was quite different from other presidents before him. He had no experience in the federal city. He had no experience at the national level. He was a man who had very effectively used the veto when he was governor of New York, the veto when he was mayor of Buffalo. How did he regard himself? What was his mission in his mind as he took on the Congress, the willful Congress dominated by lords? Good evening to you.
Good evening, John. It's a delight to be with you. The answer to that question, Grover Cleveland is a man who takes the verb preside very seriously in presidency. This is a guy who, as you suggest, had used the veto very aggressively as mayor of Buffalo, had used the veto very aggressively as governor of New York. And his conception of the presidency and of presidential power, especially in his first term, is in many ways negative in nature. I say in the book that Cleveland kind of sees himself as a kind of ombudsman in chief, right? This is a guy who thinks that the responsibility that comes with heading the executive branch is really to keep the legislative branch in check. It's just as important to stop the depredations of Congress as it is to have any sort of affirmative executive agenda. And so that is a constant that you see throughout both of Cleveland's terms, although, and I'm sure we'll get to this later, in his second term, he does evolve a bit. He does begin to look a bit more like a modern president. It takes the lead, is a little more aggressive, a little more often. But Cleveland, and this is one of the reasons that he is so beloved by many libertarians today, many limited government conservatives, is a guy who really takes the negative power of the presidency seriously. And as a result, he vetoes 414 pieces of legislation in his first term, which is more than all 21 of his predecessors combined. So this is a pretty central element of the presidential style of Grover Cleveland.
Let's touch on some of the policy issues, because he's always on the righteous side, and that puts him up against the influence peddling, sometimes known as Congress. Okay, tariffs. We also think of it as protectionism. What was his opinion as he came into office?
Cleveland had not dealt with this issue very much in lower office. He's relatively new to it when he comes to office, but he very quickly comes to the conclusion that tariff rates need to be reduced. If this sounds strange that this would be so central to the president of the United States, it's important to understand that in the late 19th century, tariffs were where the money was, where the revenue was for the federal government. We don't have an income tax at this time. The vast majority of the federal government's money is coming from tariffs. Your only other sources are excise taxes, selling land in the West occasionally. But Cleveland's conception of the tariff issue is interesting because it is sort of the opposite of how tariffs usually get talked about today, by which I mean Cleveland's position was because he looked at the tariff system as it existed and saw that the companies that got the tariffs to protect their business interests were the ones who had the most influence in Washington, were the ones who could get to the member of the House or the Senate to give them that sort of special protection. So Cleveland thought, if I'm lowering tariffs, I am reducing the sort of corporate government collusion at the same time that I'm keeping prices low for Americans in their capacity as consumers. So his conception of this, very much the opposite of the way we tend to talk about tariffs today.
Civil service. Didn't Grover Cleveland know the job of a president is to hand out patronage to his own party? Was that a complete surprise to him?
It seems to have been a bit. I mean, I'm sure we'll touch on this multiple times throughout this conversation, but there is a righteousness born out of his religious upbringing that you see consistently throughout Grover Cleveland's life. And look, up until, you know, this moment in the 1880s, this is not a system that a lot of people object to too strenuously, right? I mean, there is a conceit throughout the middle of 19th century politics that this is just sort of how you do politics. Your party wins the White House. You hand out a bunch of government jobs. Some of them will be done well. Some of them will be done okay. Some of them probably be terrible, but that's the price of doing business. That's how you keep a party together. And Cleveland objects to this system, and he comes to office with the idea that, look, if there are Republicans who are in office who are doing these jobs well, I will keep them. If there are Democrats who will do them well, I will put them in office. But he is really sort of blowing up the edifice of how executive branch politics is done in the 19th century. It is like a lot of the issues that he deals with in his first term. I spend a lot of time in the book trying to situate it in the context of the time because these seem so exotic. These are not things that we talk about anymore. If we talk about civil service protections today, it's usually on the opposite end of the spectrum. It's the idea that government employees are too hard to fire. And Cleveland really is sort of upending the way that business has been done here. And it's worth noting, this is the first time the Democrats have won the White House since 1856, when he comes in 1884. So the idea that he's going to keep some qualified Republicans in government positions does not go down well with the more partisan members of the Democratic Party. And this is the first of many fights that he's going to have with members of his own party throughout his administration.
He keeps two famous men on in their jobs as he inherits from the previous administration, the recorder of deeds, Frederick Douglass, and Theodore Roosevelt, the civil service reform agent. Chester Arthur signed civil service reform despite his instincts. And T.R. is making his way towards the presidency with his thinking about cleaner government. Good for Cleveland to get credit for them, but he also at the same time was taking on the Grand Army of the Republic. Grand Army of the Republic we associate today with Frederick Douglass, who was a friend of Abraham Lincoln's, and Teddy Roosevelt entirely because he, as a young man, watched Lincoln's funeral through the streets of New York. Taking on the GAR, what did that mean to Cleveland? Why did he take that risk of rejecting all those pensions?
So the context for this is that when you're coming out of the Civil War, Cleveland has no objection to this system, but Cleveland is a real green eye shades guy. I mean, he cares about not spending a cent beyond what the government needs to spend. But there's also a moral principle at work here. Cleveland starts vetoing lots and lots of these pensions because he sees a clear pattern of many of them being fraudulent, people making claims that they wouldn't be eligible for. And the Republicans in Congress basically using this as a kind of constituency building, right? It is not dissimilar from the way earmarks were used, in that you get a couple people from your district who want a pension. They maybe have a colorable case for it, and you just push it through. And the next time, the guy who votes for this one will vote for yours, and so on and so forth. Cleveland regards it as a serious moral principle at stake, by which I mean his problem here, and the reason that he is willing to risk the wrath of the GAR, which is the Union Veterans Organization, is because he thinks it's actually so significant, so important, that people who really did stand up in an hour of maximum peril and put their lives on the line for the sake of union, that they be alone on the pension rolls, not that they be side by side with these people who've just learned how to game the system. He thinks that that's a betrayal of not only of the taxpayers, but of the people who actually made the sacrifices, to be indifferent as to whether somebody gets this for having taken a huge risk on behalf of their country versus whether they got it just because they figured out how to get some money out of Washington.
Doesn't sound like a politician, doesn't he? Does he? A man of iron. The turbulent life and improbable presidency of Grover Cleveland. Where did he come from? New England. So when we come back, the education of Grover Cleveland, born 1837, president in 1885. This is CBS Eye on the World with Troy Senek, the author. I'm John Batchelor.